Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on chumbacasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's chumbacasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Welcome back to Killer Fun, where we explore the intersection of crime and entertainment every other week. I'm Christy, and today we have a encore presentation of one of our favorite and most popular episodes from 2020. The Dirty Truth About John was all about Dirty John, the television show, and we talk a little bit about how that differed from the actual story and the articles and podcasts and different things that came out surrounding that unbelievable and unfortunately far too common situation. Thank you so much for letting us extend our hiatus just a little bit. It has been so great for us to be able to concentrate on some other stuff and to do some planning for the future. So speaking of that planning, join us in just 2 more weeks when we talk about Killing Eve. It is a BBC show that is right up our alley. So crimey, so much psychological stuff to dig into, so interesting, fictional with a little bit of stuff rooted in reality. It's going to be great. So make sure you tune in for that. And, you know, follow us on the socials. You can find us on Facebook, Killer Fun Podcast, Exploring the Intersection of Crime and Entertainment. You can find us on Twitter at KillerFunPod, or you can send us an email, KillerFunPodcast@gmail.com. So, you know, don't forget to do all the things, rate and review, and we hope that you enjoy this encore episode.
Okay, round 2. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry, we were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Welcome back to Killer Fun, where we explore the intersection of crime and entertainment every other week. I'm Christy.
And I'm Jackie.
And we're so glad that you're back with us today. Today, we are talking about Dirty John. It was on Bravo, and now it's on Netflix, and it was a podcast and a article series before that.
It's a true story.
And it's true. Well, what's in the show is mostly
I'm
true.
Sure they've taken a lot of liberty.
But we'll talk about those.
The generality is it's based on a true story.
And it's pretty.
And you know what? This stuff really happens. I have personally not experienced it, but I have experienced it via as a friend who got sort of
taken like this? Oh, man, it's so hard to watch them go through it.
It's so hard.
Isn't it?
You can't convince them of anything.
Nope, because they're going to give their money to the scammers or sleep with the scammer.
Yeah.
I mean, he's a con man.
This is what they do for a living. And then you can't blame them or blame anybody for having been conned. I mean,
I'm sorry.
Not
I
the con
jumped
men.
To a conclusion. No. Yeah, we blame the
I'm
con men.
The women, especially, because, you know, there's a reason why these guys do this, because they're really good at it. They know what they're doing. So, I mean, it's like, well, of course. I mean, you can't blame yourself for being taken a little bit.
Yeah.
You know?
You can say, I wish you'd been less naive, or I wish you'd listened to the people in your life who were trying to help you.
But those con men, they know. They know that people in their lives are going to tell them differently, and they have a plan for that, too. They know.
Yeah, they do.
It's scary.
Yeah, they do.
The gentleman who, and I say use that word very loosely, mm-hmm. who conned a friend of mine, he ended up being wanted at like 11 states.
Did they catch him?
Nope. And then it's been long enough now that we probably wouldn't hear an update even if he was caught.
Well, he's probably not using the same name.
Probably not. Yeah, hilarious, right?
Hilarious in that I want to roll my eyes and cry.
Exactly.
Not in the ha-ha, boy, isn't that funny.
Yeah, funny weird, not funny ha-ha, as TVS used to ask.
Yeah. All right, so let's talk about who's in this. The lovely Connie Britton plays Deborah Newell. She was in Friday Night Lights, Country Music Television's Nashville, 24. I remember her back from Spin City with Michael J. Fox.
Oh.
And I was like looking at her bio and I'm like, well, yeah, I know I didn't really watch Friday Night Lights. I didn't watch Nashville. You know, that's not where I recognize her from. And I'm like, Spin City.
That is so funny.
Uh-huh. Then we have Eric Bana as John Meehan. He was in Hulk, which was not something I was familiar with, but I have seen The Other Boleyn Girl, which he was in, which I read
that
book and saw the movie. And it was very interesting, a different kind of take on that time frame. And a lot of it's fictionalized because they don't really know, but Henry VIII was the father of her children.
Right.
So he was also in The Time Traveler's Wife.
Yeah, and I never saw that either.
I didn't either.
But I did see Troy.
Yeah. Oh.
And I love Troy.
Yeah. Well, he's just so pretty.
Wow.
He's so pretty. Why do we think that these dark, brooding men are pretty?
Well, he was pretty, but I have to admit, there's another pretty face in that film that takes
in
the
Troy?
Cake. Mm-hmm. Which one do you think it is?
I don't know. I don't think I've seen that movie.
You haven't seen Troy? We have issues. Stop the tape. We're like, what? Holy crap. Okay, Troy, Brad Pitt, Eric Bana, and Orlando Bloom.
Oh, God. It's going to hurt because they're so much pretty.
Oh, they're so much pretty.
Oh, man. They're like prettier in their pinky finger than I'll ever hope to be.
I mean,
but
I understand. It's just, I don't understand where they get it from. I don't know.
Kissed by an angel. Isn't that what they used to say?
And there's a song for that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yep, but Brad Pitt was my my favorite in that group. But Eric Bana is fantastic in it. Yeah.
Then we have Juno Temple, who plays Veronica Newell. She was in Maleficent. She was also in The Other Boleyn Girl. She was in Atonement. And she was in a movie called Horns with Daniel Radcliffe.
Really?
Yeah, and it, like, I can't decide if it looks terrible or interesting. Because Daniel Radcliffe, you know, little Harry Potter has horns, and it's kind of weird.
Yeah, that's going to be hard. I don't know.
But it might be fun to laugh at.
It might be fun to watch, though.
Yeah, it's one of those.
Fall in love with it.
Yeah. I don't know. I'd have to, like, really hunt down a place to watch it, and I don't know if I'm willing to do that. Then we have Julia Gardner, who plays Tara.
Love her.
Oh, my gosh. She was amazing in Ozark. You and I
love
were just
her.
Talking about this. And we're like, we got to talk about this while we're recording. It's wasteful to talk about it when we're not recording.
Exactly. I love this chick.
Oh, she's so great.
She's so good.
So, like, spunky and smart. And she's not, like, ultra smart in this. But
You haven't gotten there yet.
I haven't
the
finished
end of the,
it.
The end of the season. She seems a little fragile and a little ditzy. She's not dumb.
No,
a little,
she's not dumb.
A little ditzy. Yeah. Your opinion of her will change.
She puts off an air that screams innocence. Like she's trying to hold on to a certain level of innocence.
Mm-hmm.
But she sees like the black chasm that's like surrounding her reality. And like reality is getting thinner and thinner for her.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, and she just wants to do right. Like she just wants to say what's right and do what's right. And there's just this beautiful innocence. But this actress, Julia Garner,
she's
something
amazing
about what she brings to the role. But she is just so expressive without being, I don't know, theatrical. And I don't know. I just love her.
Yeah.
I can't wait to see her work forever.
Then we have Jean Smart, who played Arlene Hart, Deborah's mom. She's been in all kinds of stuff. She was in most recently, like The Watchmen on HBO, which is amazing. It's so weird, but it's so good. It's so good. She's in 24, Frasier, Designing Women.
Hello, Designing Women.
Designing Women.
I mean, I grew up watching that show. Okay, and it's on Hulu.
Mm-hmm.
And I have been going back and watching it every once in a while. Oh my gosh.
That's
going to
be my next
it.
One. I'm going back through and watching all the Golden Girls because
yeah?
all on Hulu.
Hello?
And I'm like, oh, I gotta be able to say, oh, I remember that episode when Jackie tells me that she's got Golden Girls and you've got your Golden Girls.
I do have my Golden Girls,
your Golden Girls
coffee
Yeti
cup right now.
Yeah. Yep. It's darling. And then the last person I have to mention before we jump into our recap is Kiko Ajena, who plays Nancy, Deborah's coworker, and she was in Gilmore Girls.
Yeah.
Yeah, she's the best friend.
Amazing.
And she's always been adorable and
rock
darling.
And drummer.
And she doesn't age.
No.
Because she looks just like she did when she was in Gilmore Girls.
Yeah.
And she was like a decade older than Rory in real life and still looked like her contemporary. I'm like, it's not fair how she refuses to age.
I know. How does she look so, so, so young?
Because she's, I don't know, beautiful. Good
she's
genes.
Beautiful.
Anyway. All right. So are we ready to jump into
our
recap?
All right. Let's recap this.
Oh my gosh. So much happens in this first
episode.
Yeah.
It's hard to hold on to a little bit.
Oh my gosh. It opens with a woman in black walking down a stark white hallway. And as she walks down this hallway, you get these flashes of blood on pavement and a knife falling to the ground and blonde hair and then just rivers of blood on the pavement. Then this woman, she steps into a hospital room and looks very concerned while a man in a suit waits outside the door. That's all we get for the opening. And then we have the little like intro. And we see this woman in black. We know it's the same woman. Long blonde hair. Beautiful lady.
Yeah. Perfect hair.
Yeah.
Let's just remember that. Perfect. God.
Perfect in every single scene.
Yeah. Everything.
It's unfair. But I'm so happy for her that she has beautiful hair. I'm just a little jealous of it.
That's fair. Absolutely.
So she's kissing this man, looks very happy, and we learn right up front that this is based on a true story, a series of articles, and a podcast by Christopher Gofford. In a very nice business park, there's a van with a sign on it that says Madeira Interiors. Inside, the woman, Deborah, the same one that we saw walking down the hallway, is looking at items inside of a well-lit storage area. And we learn that she's the main head honcho at this interior design company, Madeira. We learn that she's online dating, which one of her coworkers is absolutely flustered by. He's like, you're beautiful. Why do you need to online date? And she's like, well, everybody online dates now.
Yeah.
Pretty much.
And she's that's like, not a lie.
No.
I mean, it seems true to me.
I'd say it seems true. I hope I never have to find
out. God, let's not go down that road.
No, let's not.
That'd be awful.
Then we see her go on several bad dates. There's the condescending workaholic lawyer. There's a guy who's really worried about the prices on the menu. There's the guy who talks with his mouth open and drinks too much. There's the guy who's talking about his troubled childhood, because that's great first date material.
Right? Like, Let me just open with that.
And the guy who's clearly not over his ex.
Oh, jeez, yeah.
Yeah, which...
I'd rather deal with that guy,
though. I would, too. I'd rather deal with, I'm not really ready to date, but I'm here,
right,
than childhood trauma or chews with his mouth open.
Or complete arrogance.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Honestly. Then we see Deborah getting ready for a date. And her daughter, who lives with her, is very concerned because the date is coming to the house. They're walking. So Deborah feels okay about it because they're walking to a place where she's a regular to have a meal together. So she's like, I'm not getting in a car. They know me there. And her daughter's like, but then he knows where you live, which yeah, I'm kind of like.
What an interesting conversation, because I think maybe not even 20 years ago, we would have been like, what is this deal with you meeting people at restaurants? Like, is he not a real man? Can he not come to your home and pick you up for a date? And now it's kind of like, what? You're first giving him his address?
Yeah,
like,
no.
Ah,
you're not meeting him in public first?
Exactly.
Yeah. And
isn't it interesting how the conversation has changed?
Yes.
And I get that the online dating has something to do with it, because if you met somebody online,
right,
then you may not want to give out your address. But now it's like kind of just a rule of thumb, like first date, you know, let's meet.
Yeah. I'm driving myself in case you're a creep and I want to get in my car and leave.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Fair. Interesting conversation.
Yeah. I thought it was really interesting.
Kind of loved it.
Yeah. If their appearance, these ladies' appearance and their beautiful home doesn't tell us that they have money, then we know they have money because the daughter is begging to borrow her Maserati since she's not going to be using it for the evening. Like, okay.
That's money.
Yeah. That's like money. So the daughter, Veronica, we learn her name, answers the door to the date, and she, quote unquote, mistakes him for a delivery person. She knows it's him, but she pretends that he must be delivering a package because he's wearing shorts and a faded polo and sneakers.
Right. Like, he looks a little ratty.
Yep.
And okay. But I have to tell you what this Vulture article says about it, because it's stinking hysterical.
Okay.
So... this is what the author says. I don't care what he is wearing, because Eric Bana could be wearing a jumpsuit made out of poisonous jellyfish, and I would still try to get all over that.
I don't know that I'd go that far.
I don't know that I'd go that far either, but I was like, that's hysterical. And you know what? Somewhat fair.
Yeah. That's awesome.
You know what? That's how you know somebody's attractive, when they show up in a ratty t-shirt and shorts and you're like, yep, still hot. You know?
So John claims he's a doctor and Veronica's not buying it. Then they head to dinner and he tells her about his time in Iraq with Doctors Without Borders, though they prefer to go by the abbreviation MSF. Okay. Then John does what no other date that we saw did, is he actually wants to know something about Deborah, about who's her hero, what inspired her to become an interior designer. You know, in hindsight, questions that he wants answered because of what he's going to do.
And that's but terrifying.
It is terrifying because... what we want as women is to be seen.
Yeah.
We want dudes. We want you to ask us the questions and hear what we have to say and tell us about yourself, but also take an interest in us. We want both.
Well, yeah. It's interesting because it's really the same thing that guys want. Guys just offer it and don't stop talking. So, and we tend to like to listen. We don't get asked as much as we tend to ask as women. Really, I think the sexes are actually more equal than we realize. It's that, well, we want to be known and share about ourselves and have somebody be interested the same way that the guys on these dates were sharing about themselves and want somebody to care. But it's so scary because this guy is a sociopath. Yeah. And so he's able to use this as an opportunity to make her feel more comfortable than she ought to, gather information that's important. It's terrifying.
It is terrifying. And I do think that it's more than just that women like to listen and want to get to know. I think particularly now in this day and age is I want you to talk about yourself so I can determine whether you're somebody I want to spend time with.
Absolutely fair.
If you're somebody that I can trust. And unfortunately, him trying to gather information about her gave her the feeling of security mm-hmm. that was unwarranted, but nobody else had done that.
Nobody else had done
that. I mean, and those men were, any one of those men, she probably should have dated than this guy.
I know, right?
Any one of them.
Mm-hmm.
Chooses with mouth open, alcoholic.
Fine.
Better.
Yeah, better. Better. It is scary. We want to know people, and you're right. Dating is still about kind of interviewing people.
Yeah.
And so you want to feel known and feel like you have an opportunity, and you want part of to know, are they interested in me?
Mm-hmm.
Are you going to, you know, I don't know, respond to my bids for affection or, you know, so that we want to know all of those things, but you're right. We also need to listen because we want to know about them. So it's this give and take and the balance has to be kind of right. And the fact that it's all about her on this date, that yeah. he's always spinning it.
Well, but it's not all about her. He shares enough to seem normal.
Yeah.
But also asks.
But then he responds with something that makes it feel like a connection.
Because yes.
once she's offered something about herself, it gives him an opportunity to go, oh, me too. And uh-huh. that creates the connection, which is how he makes it then about her. And so there's enough of like a, oh. it's just a whirlwind,
it's
right?
It's like, it's unnerving how good he is at it.
Yeah.
And So they get a little tipsy and they head back to Deborah's place. And they smooch, and she kind of breaks away because it's going a little too fast. But she's delighted by it. But it's going a little too fast. And she comes out of the master bathroom where she's just put a little toothpaste in her mouth. Been there, done that. And he's laying on her bed. And now he's fully clothed.
Yeah, he is fully clothed, but he is straight Thank up God. On her bed.
Yeah, telling her how comfortable it is and what an amazing bed she has.
Yeah.
And she's like, yeah, no, I want to go back to the living room. And what struck me about this is how politely she asks him, because she recognizes as a woman, and this is a thing I think men even still don't really realize, is how women are often polite because they're afraid.
Oh, nailed it.
And she's super polite, but she's firm, but she's really polite because she doesn't want to anger him, because she recognizes that this is a man who is stronger than she is.
Mm-hmm. And they're alone.
And they're alone.
Yep.
And she doesn't expect her daughter home, or she wouldn't have let him come in.
Right. Exactly. And so, and he knows that.
Yeah. And he knows that
at that point.
Yeah.
So nailed it.
Oh my gosh. So he leaves in a huff, like doesn't talk to her, just yeah. walks out. And I'm like, that'd have been enough for me.
That'd have been the end of that, right?
Yeah. But he calls and apologizes.
Which is so obnoxious, because you know what? He set that up on purpose. He knows that if he storms out, she'll feel guilty. He knows it, and then he can be the good guy who's like all apologetic and humbling, which he gets to, quote, share about himself again in a way that he knows will make her feel something about him.
Yo, oh, I self-sabotaged. You were so perfect. You were just like your online profile when so many women I've met were not. In other words, you're as rich as you look. That's let's read the subtext here.
Yep.
You're as rich as you look, and you're pretty, and your picture's current, and I feel like I would like to take advantage of you.
So scary.
The whole self-sabotage thing was like, I could see it working on her, and I'm like, you're stupid. I mean, you're not stupid because you're not a stupid person, but you're blinded.
Right. Completely blinded. But he is playing it.
He's
so
really good at it. And that's why, and that gives you a little more sympathy for Deborah, I think.
I think it does.
Because he's really good at it.
Yeah, he knows what he's doing.
Yep. So we see John talking to a woman about debulking surgery, and we come to the impression that she's got ovarian cancer. He's in his scrubs, and that she's about to go into surgery. So that's just a quick flash. Then we see another date, and she's talking about her kids, how her son Trey is really settled. She worries about her daughters, Veronica and Tara. They talk about being divorced, and John wishes that he'd known the number one predictor of divorce was eye-rolling. And Deborah says she wants someone to face her problems with rather than fight against. And obviously, her ex wasn't somebody she could fight with rather than against. Tonight, he won't go in because he wants to do it right. And I'm like, in hindsight, such manipulation.
It is manipulation, but yeah. It is. That's the key about manipulation, is that it's always wrapped in truth.
Yeah.
And that's what makes it hard.
Yeah. Makes it hard to decipher until you're looking at it after the fact.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Deborah and Veronica go to counseling together, and Veronica expresses concern over John, which makes sense. And Deborah says that no man's ever going to be good enough for her, according to Veronica. Also fair. And then we learn that Deborah's been married and divorced 4 times.
Yeah, 4.
That's a lot.
It now, is a lot. You
know, it's just maybe take a break. Decide you're going to, I'm not going to marry anybody until we've been dating for 3 years. Once you're past divorce number 3.
Yeah, right.
You need to be a little more conscious.
I would even say divorce number 2.
Yeah.
You
yeah,
know?
Yeah.
Because in that case, you have the potential for a pattern.
Mm-hmm. That's you know? Fair.
Because the first marriage has a certain, you know, there's a rate of success, right? And these are not statistics that you can then just, you know, go to the bank with. But it is known that the second marriage has a harder time surviving than a first one that has failed. So,
right.
You know, it's just really hard. I think once you're on the third one, most people take it real slow at that point.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And she is somebody who's really rich. And so I wouldn't have been surprised if she had married people who she didn't realize was kind of taking advantage of her.
Mm-hmm.
She might be more apt to end up married a couple like extra times only because her particular position, you know, some
right.
people do. Some people are in positions where it's harder than some other people, but
yeah.
Yeah. But once you're like 4 times, introspection time, man.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, like maybe just don't get married.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, maybe just don't.
Yeah.
Maybe just date.
Yeah.
I don't
for
know.
For a while.
And I'm not there. But
yeah. Yeah.
I don't know.
Me either. But it just seems like, I don't know, a little slower would have been probably well advised. And it seems like somebody did try to advise her daughter, but it came maybe from a person whom she couldn't hear it from.
She couldn't hear it from, and it sounded like all the other times.
Yeah.
And, you know, I get that. I understand that.
Yeah.
I get that.
Yeah.
That's hard.
Yeah. So the physical relationship between Deborah and John advances, and he tells her about a scar on his stomach, and he said only people who survive have scars, which I'm like, oh, that's kind of interesting. That's a little foreshadowing, too. If you have only watched the first episode of this show, just know there's more to that story. John spends the night, and he sees Veronica going into her handbag safe in the morning, and hey, what you got in there, kiddo? And she's surprised to see him, annoyed to see him, annoyed that he's seen in her safe, that she has a safe. She's not happy about this.
I'm not happy about this.
No.
This is like the point where I'm like, I now hate you.
Yeah.
If I had any redeeming characteristics, if I kind of liked who you were and were kind of holding out hope that maybe it wasn't as predatory as the story indicated, now I hate you.
Yeah.
Because who are you to be looking in this woman's room? Ah!
He shouldn't have been anywhere near her bedroom.
Anywhere near it.
Mm-mm.
Oh, no.
Yeah. So John and Deborah are talking over breakfast about how they're going to be attending this ovarian cancer treatment benefit. It's a black tie. She reminds him to pick up a tux. And later we'll see him show up in his dirty, nasty scrubs saying that, oh, surgery ran late and I didn't have a charger, so I couldn't call you.
Yeah.
So she confesses after they have this black tie event that he shows up to, that they have a wonderful time at, he shows up completely underdressed.
Well, he shows up on purpose in those scrubs.
Yes, because he wants people to think he's a doctor.
Mm-hmm. He needed other people to corroborate.
Yeah, doctor-ness.
Yeah.
Yes. She confesses to John that she's been married actually 4 times, and he says he doesn't care and professes his love for her, and then they start looking for houses together in Balboa Island.
What is this, like a week? A week? I mean, it's like 4 days.
It's 4 weeks, I think.
So, it just feels so fast. That was one thing about the show I really was kind of like, they didn't really show that passage of time well.
Yeah.
And it took me a while to figure out, like, how long has this been?
They get better at it.
They do get better at it.
Yeah, well, because everything happened really fast.
It does actually happen really fast. But I was sitting there going, yeah, wasn't their first date like 2 days ago? Like, or was it been a week or something? Or,
yeah.
I was really confused for a while.
It was not a very long time.
Mm-mm.
So they start looking for houses, and he says that he would get this lovely house on the water for them if it weren't for his child support and insane tax issues. And Veronica's dressed to go out to Halloween. That's where we kind of start seeing some indicators of how much time has passed. They start it pretty. They didn't do a good job from first date to looking for houses on Balboa Island, but after that, they do a really good job.
They get better.
Yeah.
Well, and there is the screen tag. I mean, there's like a lower third thing going on there, and it says 5 weeks. So you do kind of figure it out. But at that point, I'm like, are they fast forwarding 5 weeks from this point, or are they describing what just happened? And so to me, I didn't really think that that was done great.
Well, maybe because I'd listened to the podcast, it made complete sense to me. So, but she's dressed for Halloween, and Deborah tells her that their therapist says that they shouldn't live together because it's detrimental for Veronica's development. And so she's going to move out and pays $84,000 upfront for a year lease, and it's been 5 weeks since their first date.
And how manipulative is that of the mother? It's so manipulative, and it made me mad at her.
And it just shows you that she knows that it's too soon.
Yeah, exactly.
Because she's lying to her family.
Mm-hmm. But people convince themselves that lying to family is the right thing to do.
Yeah.
And it's, I get it.
Yeah.
Only that it's very interesting to have that sort of private, secret kind of thing going on. And so,
yeah, I know, it's tough. It's so tough. Then we see the cancer patient again, and she's in a lot of pain, and John tells her he's going to take it away. That's just a quick flash. So we've seen the cancer patient twice now.
Mm-hmm.
Then Tara, Deborah's daughter.
The youngest.
Her youngest. And her boyfriend, Jimmy, Tara's boyfriend, Jimmy, arrive for Thanksgiving. They get there a little early. They're moving into this house on Balboa Island. And John's really, like, super rude to them because they're early. And he wasn't expecting them yet. And Deborah's not there. And he makes a really bad first impression.
He does. He is really nasty to them.
Yeah. Tara kind of gets the impression that they're living together, even though Deborah has explicitly said that John doesn't live there, that it's just nice for him to have some things over, but he absolutely does live there. And so they're talking about it, Veronica and Tara, that evening, and neither one of them like him, and they decide Tara's going to do some snooping. So she kind of snoops, and they have a little altercation. It's troubling. And John already starts, like, low-key trying to isolate her from her family at Thanksgiving. He's like, why don't you ask Tara to go and get these new apples for you? Because that's an easy thing that she can do to actually be helpful. And she's like, oh, no, she's with her sister. And he's like, maybe you should stop doing everything for your children. I mean, like,
little things.
And he's not, maybe not wrong, but he's not totally right either. that's for her to choose. And well, for him to make this insinuation after like 5-6 weeks.
Right. And he jumps in like at one point when they're in the closet and don't talk to your mother that way. Like he starts to act sort of authoritarian. It almost gives, it gives the impression to Deborah that, you know, she's got somebody on her side finally when she's always been kind of left alone. That whole fight with against instead of fight mm-hmm. against. And, you know.
Unfortunately, what they're fighting against is her daughter.
Exactly. And so then he continues it with this whole isolation thing.
And he like veiled threats of he's going to hit her and she ought to be hit. And that would teach her a lesson.
Oh, maddening.
Oh, man.
At this point, I'm even more mad at Deborah because she's allowing this to go on, you know.
You got it. You got it. Tara and Jimmy leave. It's kind of unclear in the show whether they're leaving of their own accord or whether they're being kicked out. In the podcast, she's being kicked out. She and Jimmy are asked to leave. And they do, and they're uninvited to Thanksgiving. And Veronica's still going to go to Thanksgiving because she wants to see the kids. And she would eat Thanksgiving dinner every day if she could. She sees her grandmother, Deborah's mom, at Thanksgiving. And Deborah's mom really likes John.
She really likes John.
She likes John a lot. And Veronica is very clear about how she still does not like him. Then we kind of fast forward a little bit and we see a Christmas tree up. So we know there's been a passage of time. He gives her a cute little ornament. It's nothing like big, but she fawns over it like it's diamonds. And Nancy, her coworker, is ill and was supposed to go on a trip with her to Vegas. And she can't go. So she asks John to drive the truck to Vegas and go to Vegas with her. And they have this lovely time. They end up eloping in mm-hmm. Vegas after 8.5 weeks mm-hmm. of knowing one another.
Yep.
Oh, and then we see our last flash of the cancer patient. She's screaming in pain and they tell her she can't have anything because she was given fentanyl at a certain time. And she screams, it's like he gave me nothing.
It's horrible to watch.
It's horrible.
Whoever played this patient.
Because you know what he's done. I mean, if you had any doubts about who this man was, as despicable as he's behaved, if you're like, maybe he's just an old school kind of guy.
No. This guy is horrible.
He is a despicable human being. And he left a cancer patient in unimaginable pain.
Yep.
He did that.
On purpose. This wasn't like an accident. You can tell it, you know.
Yeah.
The question I have is, do you think that he orchestrated Nancy's getting ill?
Oh, I don't know.
Or do you think he took advantage of an open opportunity?
I think he took advantage of an open opportunity, or that's what we're led to believe, because I don't think that actually happened quite that way.
Okay.
Yeah. I think that she invited him to go. It wasn't that. I think that was a little of the creative liberty that they took. So I thought this show was really good.
I did too.
I really enjoyed it. IndieWire found it a little lacking, and I think they liked the articles and the podcast more. They found some things to pick at.
What did they not like?
Well, they said Dirty John, Bravo's new limited series adapted from the podcast of the same name, does the unthinkable. It makes you not care about Connie Britton. And they just thought she was a little, she didn't have enough depth.
I have to say, in that I sort of agree.
You know, I was like, I really like this. And then I read that and I'm like, oh, they're kind of right.
It was fascinating, but I definitely felt the same way.
Right.
I think what helped is having seen somebody I cared about go through it.
Oh,
I think that gave the character more depth for me just naturally. But I think they're absolutely spot on because there was more times where I was mad at Deborah.
Yes. Yes.
And
agreed.
I kind of thought you deserve each other.
Okay.
And that's horrible.
Yeah. And they kind of thought they didn't have enough chemistry either. They said the couple's lack of chemistry makes their whirlwind romance less forgiving for Deborah. The audience gets why John is moving so fast. He's up to no good, even if it's unclear exactly how bad things will get. But viewers need to see why Deborah would fall so hard for this guy. And they do a really good job in the podcast. I listened to the first episode of the podcast, which is really like the first episode of the show.
Uh-huh.
And she talks about, you know, how loving he was and how, you know, thoughtful, and he would run errands for her. And it was just like he made her life easier in a lot of ways mm-hmm. that nobody had done for quite some time.
That makes sense. I think it is hard on a TV show to show the different perspectives, because I think for anybody on the outside, they're looking at the couple going, y'all don't have any chemistry.
Right.
What in the world is going on here? It doesn't look right to people on the outside. And yet the people on the inside are fully bought in, either as the predator,
right,
who's fully bought in and focused, or the person who is being conned. They have a lot of reason why they're fallen in love and why they feel like there's so much chemistry. And that's why they always have to defend their relationship to others, because right. others are like, it's not like y'all go together like two peas in a pod. Like,
yeah.
it's just clear that it's very contrived to people on the outside. I think the episode really, I felt like the outsider watching the whole relationship form, where you can just see
seeing it more from like the daughter's perspective
yes.
than from Deborah's perspective.
Yes.
And I think the podcast was a little more from Deborah's perspective. And so we kind of got a little bit more of that, though we do hear from the daughters.
Right.
So
I'd love to hear that. But I do think that that's why the character doesn't have enough depth in this episode, because we're not seeing it from her perspective.
Yeah.
But and unfortunately, it makes her out to be more of a villain instead of just somebody who is a victim, I guess.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Well, I mean, it's easy in hindsight when you kind of have some idea of what's coming to judge her more harshly
mm-hmm.
than if you're in it.
Exactly. So, exactly.
And if you like this show, there is going to be a second season. But it's not going to be about Deborah and John. It's going to turn into a serialized show.
No.
Where each, or an anthology type of show, not really serialized, anthology. So every season will focus on a different awful man and how he victimized woman.
Interesting.
Yeah. Which I have thoughts about. Like, I want a little more about the stories where, you know, it's not just white men doing awful things to other people. I want a little more than that, because we get a lot of that. But also, that's really interesting.
I know. It's very conflicting, right?
It is conflicting. Hmm. So let's chew on that and take a quick break.
Leave the Lights On is a true crime podcast with a paranormal twist. Join creator Eliza and her co-host as they explore terrifying true stories and chilling crimes. Growing up, Eliza had an odd obsession with the darkest desires of humanity and an insatiable curiosity about the afterlife. Now, each week, Eliza brings you tales that will make you want to lock your doors, hide in your room, and of course, leave the lights on. Available on Spotify and Apple Podcasts.
All right, and we're back. Thanks for sticking with us through that quick break. Now, is it true? A lot of this is true.
It's scary how...
It's scary how much of it is true?
I think so. I mean, I know they took a lot of liberty. We already kind of said that, right?
Yeah.
But the basic story...
Yes. I mean, what happens? That he conned her, victimized her, that she was a little less astute than she should have been, what actually happens at the end of the show, which I'm not going to spoil it because I know you haven't seen
and you don't know
what's going to happen. So I went into it watching it knowing exactly what was going to happen.
Yeah, and I'm at the last three episodes.
Okay, yeah. I know how the story ends, and I don't know if you're going to see it coming. Is it true? E! Online had a really fascinating article about what the show changed. A lot of it had to do with her children. So she actually has four children, not three, but her oldest daughter was never a part of any of the media. She wasn't really in the articles. Like, I don't think they even said her name. They indicated that there was an oldest daughter, but never said her name. Mm. She didn't give interviews, any of that. And Veronica is not her name. Veronica's, the daughter's name is actually Jacqueline.
Oh.
Yeah. So.
So they changed it.
Yeah.
Why? Did they indicate?
She wanted it changed. So when they first started production, not production really, like when they first started working on the television show portion of it, they had the rights to be able to use Deborah and Tara's names, mm-hmm. but they hadn't yet secured that formally for some other people in the show. And one of those was Jacqueline.
Okay.
And so they did eventually get whatever rights they needed to be able to kind of tell her story, to bring her on board, which she was always on board, but she said she'd rather have her name not be used. She'd rather have it be a different name.
That makes sense.
And I'm like, that's fine. And that was a respectful, intentional change that they made. And Juno Temple, who plays Veronica in the show, she met Jacqueline at the premiere of the show. They did like a big fancy premiere. The first thing that Jacqueline said to Juno was that the safe was bigger in real life. Which I found very endearing.
That is a very unique character aspect. It is funny.
It's so on brand. They nailed her.
They nailed it. I don't know who does that. Like I have never met somebody who has a large safe with anything but guns in it.
Yeah, that's true.
Definitely not Parsons.
I mean, we have a safe. It's not that large. And if anybody broke into it, they'd be very disappointed because it's like tax documents.
Right? It's like exactly.
Most boring stuff ever.
Yep. We're the same. It's like a fireproof box. It's not really even a safe.
Right. But I mean, it's got a code and a key and all that. So, but
like the gun safe is bigger. Like that's hardy, but you know, but not purses. And that's just so interesting. But it ain't wrong, I guess. I mean,
they're worth a lot of money.
They
and she takes a lot of pride in taking very good care of them.
She which really good does. For her.
So the quickie wedding in Las Vegas. So actually it kind of seems like a mutual decision, but really John had been pressuring Deborah already to, I want to marry you. I love you. I want to marry you. Really kind of pushing hard for it.
You know what? You know what? It's like, okay, you want to do this? Fine. But prenup.
Yeah, exactly.
Kanye was right. Prenups.
Well, especially her. She's self-made, wealthy. Yeah. I mean, she worked hard.
It's so sad you have to say that. And I know it just it's a buzzkill to the romance. I understand that. But
I mean, it's different when you're both poor, neither of you have anything, and you get married. I mean, then, you know, no matter who made the money, you deserve half because you did that as part of a team. But was 59.
Yeah.
She had worked her entire life to be able to. Oy vey. So probably the biggest edit from the original story was about John's rehabilitation and Deborah helping him detox. She never saw him go through a detox, really. She thought that the prescription drugs that he had were because he'd had back surgery, and he's actually very serious heroin user, and she didn't realize that.
Dang.
And that's not clear in the show.
No.
It really looks like he's just using like stolen prescription medication, but it's heroin.
Wow.
He had a pretty severe heroin addiction.
Interesting.
And she didn't know it. And I think that's a sign that she didn't see it. And more of a sign of how good he was at hiding it.
I think so.
I really think so.
Probably
that was the impression that I got. And then, you know, there's some other details that they left out. You know, he shows up at her house for their first date with like kind of raggedy looking. And he tells her, dress me, I want to please you in real life. And she took him to Brooks Brothers and bought him a whole new wardrobe and so that he would be dressed appropriately. Like, he just made it out like, you know, I have some financial issues, but they're not my fault. And I don't have any sense of style. So dress me, because you, interior designer, have a beautiful sense of style. It was real manipulative the way he...
See, that feels a little too on the nose. I have to say, like, that makes me wonder about her, unfortunately, because I'm thinking that just seems less manipulative and just flat out.
Right. Yeah.
Abusive or,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I don't know how it was put to her, but I'm not going to talk about it because there's tons of spoilers, but Bizarre has a really, really interesting timeline of all of the events, like starting from way back, like 1984 is where this timeline starts, so that you can really get a whole picture. And I'm not going to talk about that here because there's tons of spoilers, okay, but find us online. You can find us on Facebook, Killer Fun Podcast, exploring the intersection of crime and entertainment. You can find us on Twitter at Killer Fun Pod, or you can send me an email at killerfunpodcast@gmail.com. If you need a link to that, I'll be happy to shoot it to you. So is Madeira Interiors a real company? No. She really did have her own real company, but it was called Ambrosia Interiors.
Oh, I like that better.
Yeah, I like it better too. It's her real company that she really built, Ambrosia. And it seems like she might have sold it or sort of passed it off, because she's not really listed on their website anymore. There's other people, though. It's going by AI or something like that. AI Interiors, Ambrosia Interiors or something like that. But they don't go by Ambrosia anymore. And she's got a Ambrosia home furniture and decor store and service where she helps like furnish model homes and things in Las Vegas now. So yeah, it was kind of interesting. And the title of this episode is called Approachable Dreams.
Yeah.
And that was her motto for how she ran her business, was she wanted to create homes that were beautiful, but also very livable.
Nice.
Yeah.
I kind of like that.
Yeah, I like
get
it
on
too.
Board.
So, Doctors Without Borders is MSF?
Yeah, what is this? What is this?
Okay, totally true, because it's actually a French organization.
Oh.
Medicines Sans Frontières, MSF.
I gotcha.
So, if you go like if you go on Twitter and find USA Doctors Without Borders, it's MSF_USA.
Gotcha.
Yeah, but their name is Doctors Without Borders. So it's kind of a translation. So the people who are actually working,
right,
you know, for that organization, when they're talking to you and me, they're going to say Doctors Without Borders, right, because that's how we know it. If they're talking with people whom they're actually working with and doing the organizing with, they're going to call it MSF. Yep. So I was wondering, is $7,000 a month rental for that house in Balboa Island, is that reasonable?
It might actually sounds low.
It's a steal. $84,000 for a year. So it works out to $7,000 a month. It's kind of a steal.
It sounds low.
So to buy a house on Balboa Island currently, now, of course, these events happened in 2014, 2015. So prices may have changed a little, but not that much. It's $2 to $10 million. And if you have I looked it up trying to figure out like what your payment would be, like if you owned a house out there. You're looking at like $7,000 a month, just the payment.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Not to mention insurance.
Yeah. And then I found this house. $12,500 a month for a 3-bedroom, 3-bath, 2,200 square feet that looks very, very much like the house that they had.
Wow, it really does kind of look like it.
It looks a lot like it, right? And it's $12,500 a month. So, yeah, like she got a steal, because she could pay $84,000 up front. Who can pay $84,000 up front for a rental? Rich people.
I love this house.
I know, it's beautiful, right? It's so gorgeous, and it doesn't even have a garage. And you know street what? Parking.
It's so perfect because it's like 2,200 square feet and 3 bedroom, 3 bath. Like, it's bigger. It's a bigger house, right? I mean, not huge, but yeah, it's also not too small. You know, it's like, oh, wow.
Yeah. And I imagine maybe that Balboa house would have been like a 2 bedroom, 2 bath, 2 bedroom, 2.5 bath.
Yeah, likely.
You know, so maybe it was a little smaller than that one, but it looks so much like that house.
It does. It looks exactly.
I mean, like, if I didn't know better, I would say that's the one they use for filming.
I mean, right?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
$12,500 a month for rent.
For rent. For rent.
Whew.
John, when he went to the black tie event.
Yeah.
He said that there was a laparotomy. And I'm like, is that
a what?
A what? Is that real? It's a real procedure. It just basically means that they're opening your abdominal cavity. Now, you don't hear it a lot. It's a little foreign to us because your doctor would probably talk more about a different kind of procedure. It would be like you have a laparotomy as part of having a hysterectomy, or have a laparotomy as part of exploratory surgery. They would call it those other things.
Then the procedure they used to get into. I mean, you hear laparoscopic.
Right. And this is like that. So laparoscopic is doing it minimally invasive. Mm-hmm. And this is where they actually have to cut open your abdomen. As gross as that is. But it's a real thing.
It's a real thing.
And then debulking. I was like,
what?
They talked about that with the cancer patient. She's about to go have the debulking surgery. And all that means is it's reducing the volume of a tumor as much as possible.
Okay.
So, but it's real. So it's like, okay.
See, there's him dropping some like details to try to act like he's in the know.
Just enough.
Just enough to make you feel like he's smarter than you. Because he's going to pull out terms that aren't so common that most people wouldn't really know, but sound familiar enough. And then they feel like they should know, but they don't. Uh-huh. Yeah. It's just one of those little things to make sure that he's on top.
Yeah. Interesting. Manipulative.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Psychology break. I've quite a few things.
Well, there's a lot to talk about.
So John claimed that he was self-sabotaging at the end of their first date. And of course, that's
a real thing.
Again, it's the lie wrapped in the truth.
Yep.
Yep. But often people don't realize they're sabotaging themselves. And a lot of it has to do with self-medication, drugs, alcohol, procrastination, things that interfere with long-term goals.
It's not so conscious as he made it sound. It's not an intentional sort of thing somebody does and then calls it self-sabotage.
Yeah.
Self-sabotage is something you kind of do unconsciously.
Right.
And that's why it has to be something that's revealed to you as you're working on it. After some time, you might realize that you're doing that sort of thing.
But for him to even talk about it kind of makes it seem like he's already been working on himself and like he's been through enough that he can now recognize it.
Right.
In himself.
That's exactly how it sounds.
Yeah.
You know?
And so it's like, oh, look at him. He's so like self-aware.
Exactly.
He can see the day after that I self-sabotaged this. I'm like,
your typical human being might say, I screwed up.
Yeah.
Like if they really did screw up, they'd be like, I screwed up.
Yeah.
And maybe they might recognize that they were nervous. They might recognize that they were feeling rejected and they don't really know how to handle that. Sure. That all could be under the umbrella of self-sabotage, but it's not really typically the thing you apologize for. I don't know.
Yeah. And it just makes him seem more self-aware than what he really is.
It's a manipulative.
It is just flat manipulative. So John said that the number one predictor of divorce was eye rolling.
That's not untrue.
It's not. I was a little surprised. Now, it's not just eye rolling.
It's not. Dr. Gottman is the one who kind of come out with this. And he's been doing research since, He's older than sliced bread with this. I mean, it's like a long time. I'm kidding. Betty White is actually older than sliced bread, not Dr. Gottman. But Gottman's been doing this research, I mean, heavily since the 70s. And his findings, it's about bids and turns and rejection. And it's that rejection when somebody does something like say, hey, look at that cat outside, which is something I might say, and somebody kind of rolls their eyes, it's a rejection. And those are so much more indicative of a lack of connection, a lack of awareness for the other person, a lack of, you know, care, you know, those are the things. And so it's not the eye rolling. It's what the eye rolling sort of indicates. And that we do that without noticing it though. So we do kind of, well, self-sabotage by, we give an eye roll because we're eye rolling, you know, don't care about the cat outside.
Yeah.
What we don't realize is that we're saying is we don't care what you say.
Yeah.
And it's hard because I don't know. I care what they say. Well, you didn't really.
Yeah.
You didn't really care. Or else you would have said, oh, really? You know, or, oh, I can't come look. Is it cute?
Uh-huh.
Anything to say, I heard you and I'm responding.
Right.
Because naturally, if you're in a good relationship or you're connected with somebody and somebody says something like that, you're, even if you can't go look or don't want to, you will do something connecting.
Oh, what color is that?
What color is it? Or, good, I'm glad he's outside because I hate cats.
Yeah.
I mean, even if you're like kind of snarky, I mean, engagement.
Uh-huh. So you're being snarky about the thing and not about the person who's talking to you.
So yeah.
That's very interesting. And it's, you know, it's contempt, criticism.
It's
all these things that you said. So that they did give in this particular article some tips maybe to just be aware of. Your delivery is really important. Don't just say whatever to your partner, whatever. Now you can say, whatever you want is fine with me, dear.
Right. But
that's fine. But
no,
where do you want to eat? Wherever, whatever. I don't care. You know, it's a disengagement.
Yeah.
As you said.
Right. Like the difference between, and then I might say, I'm up for anything.
Right.
That's different. I'm engaging in the conversation.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, be careful of sarcasm because it can be really mean-spirited. Now, some people like sarcasm as their love language, and that's okay. But you got to make sure that everybody's on board with that and that they understand how you're saying it.
Yeah.
And how you mean it.
Sarcasm is a very difficult thing.
Yeah.
And I think my son, when he was about 12 or 13, said it the best. He was like, sarcasm takes a certain type of relationship.
Mm-hmm.
So you better make sure you have a relationship before you employ sarcasm. But I would also add that sarcasm is often conflated with doublespeak.
Yes.
And with snarky.
Yeah.
Being snarky is not sarcasm. Sarcasm is literally saying the opposite of what you mean.
Right.
Not saying what you mean with humor attached so that you're not responsible for it.
Mm.
If you're being nasty, but then you're saying it with like a joke and acting like that makes it okay.
Yeah.
No.
Oh, it doesn't make it okay.
That doesn't make it okay.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Don't live in the past. Don't relive the issues that you've had in the past. It's okay to like talk about them and work through them and find ways around them for the future, but don't like live in it. Don't sit there in it. Watch your body language. Mm-hmm. That can be important. This one's for you. Don't ever tell your spouse you're overreacting.
Oh my gosh.
It's like saying, calm down. You know what? Nobody ever calmed down after somebody said, calm down.
Never once.
Mm-mm. If you find yourself feeling or acting contemptuous, take a deep breath.
Pause. Yeah.
Pause.
Big pauses.
And think, how is this going to come across to this person who's, I value their relationship, but it's already in a bad place.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I should take a deep breath before I throw out this thing that's biting or vile or hurtful or funny but mean.
Yeah.
You know?
Right. Pauses are good.
Deborah said she wanted we versus me relationship, and she hadn't yet found that and was really looking for it. And that's really like a good thing to work towards. If you're not already there, then it's definitely, you don't want two people who are working as independent people. You want to be a team.
You want to be a team.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, this article in HuffPost is really interesting. We versus me couples, talking about how we couples tend to take themselves less seriously. They're more like, you know, if your car, the example they give is if your car is stolen, you know, you're like, oh, this is terrible and it's awful. And one of you calls the insurance and one of you calls the rental car company and one of you calls the police and you start living your life again while you work it out together instead of, why did you park the car there?
Right.
Did you, why you left the keys in it? What are you, stupid? You know, no, that's not helpful.
That doesn't sound helpful. No.
Those are me couples who are fighting about, you parked it in the wrong place. You didn't lock it. You did this. You did that. The reason it's done is because your fault, instead of, this is a bad thing that happened to us. Let's work to fix it.
Yeah. That makes sense.
Yeah. I thought it was interesting. Mm-hmm. And then the high failure rate of second and third marriages.
Oh, well, we have talked about that already a little bit.
Just that it's, you know, up to 67% of second and 73% of third marriages end in divorce. And it might be because people get married too quickly. Hello, Deborah and John. Mm-hmm. Married too quickly. They haven't looked at what caused their relationships to fail in the past. That's a level of introspection that I really think that few people end up at after a failed marriage. They don't have a level of introspection to say, they tend to blame the other person a lot. And at least in my anecdotal experience from people I know who've been divorced, they tend to blame the other person a lot and not really kind of take a hard look at, okay, how did I contribute to that bad situation? And how can I avoid making those mistakes in the future?
Right.
It's or a really how, hard thing to do.
Yeah, it is. And I mean, part of that even is if you identify the partner's contribution, that's fine to do that. But then also to realize, why did I choose that partner? Why did I allow myself a part of this situation? And that's the hard part, because it's taking responsibility for your life.
Right.
But not necessarily having to take responsibility for the poor choices of somebody else.
Right.
You know, and that's really, that is a lot of division. There's a lot of like separating the bone and the marrow going on there, because you're having to decide that it's not my fault, but it's my responsibility. And that can be a really offensive thing when you're hurt and raw or going through challenges, because it's hard to separate those two things. But when you're in a healthy place, you can kind of separate it, because all of a sudden one feels like, okay, now I've identified the problem, and then responsibility is I have the opportunity to change it. It's more like inspiration. Mm-hmm. Whereas when you're in the middle of crisis, responsibility and fault feel like the exact same thing.
Yes.
It's very hard.
Yes. Well, in this article by Mark Banchik in Psychology Today, he says he really thinks that second, third, and subsequent marriages fail more often because there's less community, often don't have children together. If you have children from your first marriage, you often don't have children in your second or third marriage. Mm-hmm. So you don't have that binding, and children really do act as a binder. Don't have a baby to save your marriage.
Don't do that. No.
Don't do that. It's a bad choice. But if you have children, it can give you incentive to stay together. And you have less intermingling of the extended family too in subsequent marriages.
Yep.
So that can make it harder, because you've got kind of two camps going on. You've got your extended family, and they have their extended family, and they're not really coming together in a lot of ways. So it segregates your life more, and it can be difficult to maintain a relationship in those circumstances.
Yeah, it really goes against the idea of the we.
Yeah.
And you know, you don't have a life that's built together, you know. And I would say that my biggest piece of advice to people who are looking for marriage is to not treat a dating relationship with the same sort of honor, respect, and acknowledgement of history together or family intertwined, binding things like children. Mm-hmm. Don't treat your dating relationship with that same respect.
That's interesting.
As long as you're dating, you are still interviewing that person. You have not made a commitment that's lifelong. Right. So don't make decisions about how you're going to treat that person in our dating relationship based on how you would treat them once you have made a commitment to go the long distance. Mm-hmm. Because if you do that, if you do it backwards, you're liable to then end up married to someone that you should not have been married to.
Right.
Because you overlooked things trying to be a good partner and having good commitment when you should have been using that as an opportunity to go, oh, red flag.
Yeah.
red flag. And so don't let commitment be there for integrity's sake. Don't let history push you to continue a dating relationship. That changes when you finally make a lifelong commitment. Your history does matter, and your commitment does matter. And, you know, at that point, it's a different ball game. But I think sometimes we miss out on the opportunity to make a better choice in marriage because we didn't spend that time dating. And Deborah does this the whole time. She treats him like as if she owes him some sort of responsible commitment or some sort of honor that he has not earned yet.
Right.
Aww. You know?
Aw, and I can see where she's coming from, where she she's looking for that committed relationship. So she's just going to pretend it's already there.
Yeah. And I think that's not uncommon. I think a lot of, especially I think younger individuals, people are getting married much later now. So maybe there's probably less incident of this. However, I know that when I grew up and when you grew up, there was definitely more of a culture of when you date somebody, you don't keep dating somebody unless you know you're going to marry them. And that idea kind of seeped into the dating relationship. And so there was this, you know, sort of commitment that the best advice I ever heard, I didn't hear it until, you know, I was like an adult and I thought, ooh, I will incorporate that into my parenting. This was the advice, and it's old advice, like from like, it was a grandmother who, you know, in the 1940s talking to her, like her daughter, like in the 50s. And they said, you're not allowed to go out with somebody a second time until you've gone out with somebody else first.
Ooh.
Because they said the point of dating is to date.
To get to know a bunch of people. Not be in a relationship. Right. Yeah. It's to get to know a bunch of people.
And figure yourself out.
Yeah.
Figure out what you like. So she said, the daughter was giving the interview and that was telling about her mom saying this. And so the daughter was saying that like, yeah, so if I really liked a guy, I had to make another date with another guy fast. Because if I wanted to go out the next Friday night with him, I had to have something happen in between. Mm-hmm. But she was like, it made me not feel so connected to one man so that I didn't give him honor he hadn't earned, commitment he didn't deserve, and I didn't give him intimacy we didn't really have.
Oh, that's good.
It's good stuff.
That's good stuff. Is 5.5 weeks too soon to move in together? Spoiler alert, yes it is. Yes it is. Here are some signs that it's too soon. You don't want to just accidentally slide into cohabitation.
Yeah, like how do you accidentally slide into it? You'd be surprised how easy it is.
Yeah. Oh yeah, especially when you're kind of in that mindset where you're giving the relationship more clout than it deserves.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. If you're using it as a way to gauge your relationship strength, it's too soon. Thank you, Huffington Post, where this article came from. If you haven't had your first big argument yet, it's too soon. I do have to say Deborah and John got it out of the way the very first night.
True.
Still too soon.
As contrived as it was.
If you haven't talked about money, it's too soon. If you feel like your partner is pressuring you into a move, it is too soon. Don't do it.
Don't do it.
So John really kind of started slyly pulling Deborah away from her family even before Thanksgiving. And isolating is really common in abusive relationships. So it's normal. This is from Break the Cycle. It's a dating and violence blog to kind of help. It's geared towards young people, teenagers usually, but a lot of it is applicable to adult relationships. So spending a lot of time together is normal. It's fun. You want to do it. You want to get to know them. You have this connection. But you want it to be something you want to do and not a command from your partner ever, because it really is a form of control. You could see this. It's a slow process. It's walking down a gradual hill, and then you look up and realize how far you've come. And that's very much what I saw John doing, was just really slowly and slyly sliding that wedge between Deborah and her children.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, Deborah did contribute to that a little bit.
Yeah.
And the way she contributed was she volunteered too much personal information to John too early.
Yeah.
When you give away your personal information to someone, you're giving them a little bit of power and leverage, and you're letting them speak to deep-seated issues in your life before they've really, you know, earned their place there.
Yeah.
And, yeah.
Super fair.
You have to be careful about that. But it's understandable how somebody ends up in that situation. Mm-hmm. Because when you feel a connection with somebody and you don't feel like you have anybody else who understands you, it is so easy to then to take all these things that have been heavy burdens and go, oh my God, somebody else understands. Please listen to this.
Uh-huh.
And
help
then,
me carry this.
Right, help me carry this. But then they give you really bad advice or they use it as leverage against you. You have to be careful about your inner circle. You know, having an inner circle around you, people you can talk to, resources you know that you can go to, those are important.
So real life. How is easy is it to really get married in Vegas?
Yeah, how is it? Is it really that easy? I mean, Rachel and Ross did it, but...
Well, it wasn't that easy, but it's pretty...
It's still pretty easy.
It's pretty easy. Well, they just don't have... I know at least in Texas, you get your marriage license and you have to wait at least 3 days before you can get married. And that's the way it is in a lot of states. Now, Texas doesn't require a blood test. A lot of states don't require blood tests anymore. Mm-hmm. I think it's less common for you to marry your cousin unintentionally than it used to be.
It definitely is.
I mean, yeah. But they don't require that. You can, as soon as you have your marriage license, you can get married in Las Vegas. So it's... pretty easy.
And the chapels, don't they like have the marriage license stuff like right there? You can just like
think so.
Sign on the dotted line and go down the aisle.
I think so. It was I don't know. It's a little bit more complicated than that, but it's still pretty easy. Mm-hmm. And I think it's mainly having to do with you might actually have to go down to like the city hall. But the city hall has like crazy hours because they want to accommodate people. So there's about 300 weddings a day or 120,000 marriage ceremonies a year in Las Vegas.
Whoa!
Yeah, that's a lot. It doesn't cost a lot for a very simple ceremony. The license itself isn't expensive. It can take as little as 10 minutes to get your marriage license. Now, if it's a particularly busy day, it might take a little longer, but... you can get married in under half an hour.
Okay, so like I have a question.
Okay.
Maybe you don't know the answer to this, but I've wondered. Okay, so I've seen shows like this, you know. Do they actually have wedding dresses that you can like rent?
I think so.
This is so funny.
And yeah, because you can have a spur of the moment wedding that's as simple or as complex as you want it to be.
It looks like people can like rent a dress so that they actually have a real wedding photo and everything.
Yep. Oh, and speaking, okay, so you know in Dirty John, that awkward wedding photo that they have, it's like super awkward, right?
It's really weird.
Okay, their real photo is no less awkward.
She didn't rent a dress.
She didn't rent a dress.
And she didn't rent a tux.
I think it's just because the picture's black and white.
Yeah, but she's not in white or...
No, it's not
or
white.
Or gray or...
No.
It's
like a darker color.
It's a darker color, like a...
Maybe that should have been a little foreshadowing. Oh.
Wow, that is really awkward.
Mm-hmm.
Why is it so awkward?
Because they'd known each other 8 weeks. Because he'd been pressuring her into getting married.
They're both like, they're holding their own rings in their hands independently. Yeah.
It almost looks like a candid photo that's the candid photo that came out kind of okay. Nobody was making a weird face, and so that's the one they bought. But it's awkward.
It is really weird.
It's super awkward. So you're really supposed to understand by the end of the episode that John took the cancer patient's medicine.
Right.
She never got the fentanyl. That's why she was in so much pain. And opioids are the most commonly diverted drug among healthcare professionals. So that's what they call it when a doctor or a nurse or a medical professional, somebody who's working in a hospital, is supposed to give medication to a patient and they keep it for themselves or keep it to sell, whatever they're going to do with it. They don't give it to the patient. It's called diverting. And it's super common. Statistics from the U.S. Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration and the American Nurses Association suggest that up to 10% of healthcare workers in the U.S. are abusing drugs.
Oh my gosh.
And a lot of those are from diversion.
Oh my gosh. That's an enormous number.
Yeah, it's terrifying. Makes you want to not go to the hospital. And it's seen at all levels of healthcare professionals. It's a stressful job. It's if you're a nurse or orderly or something like that, can be underpaid.
Wow.
That not excuses.
Not reasons, excuses, not but excuses. Reasons. Yeah. 10% though. That's
and ooh. They think that only a fraction are ever caught. Because they don't catch 10% doing this. Mm-hmm. They think about 10% are doing this. It's like Nurse Jackie. Did you ever see that show?
I didn't watch it.
No. Oh, it was so good. It's so hard to watch, though, at some points. But she was a full-on junkie.
Oh.
Yeah. Really good at her job, but a full-on junkie.
Interesting.
Yeah. What we saw here, there's a lot of ways to notice diversion. And the one that we see here with John is that he's documented that the patient received medication when she did not get it. Really, it's difficult to prevent because everybody knows the processes who's working in the hospital that are supposed to prevent this diversion. And so they understand how to circumvent them.
How to get around it.
Yeah. So that makes it really difficult to discover. And really, there's just no good answers about that right now. And, you know, hope springs eternal. Deborah has a new boyfriend as of the fall of 2019.
Does she really?
She does, but she's not married to him. And she says she learned a lot from her relationship with John as to what to look for so that she could not be manipulated again. And I hope, far be it for me to tell the lady who's been married 5 times that she shouldn't date anybody.
Oh, right.
I'm just glad she's finally getting a little smarter about it.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. I hope that this is something that's good for her.
Yeah, yes, exactly.
Because she does deserve have a good relationship.
And, you know, when you listen to the podcast and she's on that, she herself did interviews for it. You hear her voice and she seems like a very sweet, kind-hearted woman. And you really do, like, you look at her and you're like, you were a little dumb, but I do just want you to be happy.
I just want you to be happy. Yeah.
So I hope that she finds that, and I hope that she finds it in the safest way. And Deborah, maybe don't get married.
Maybe not.
Maybe just at least not for a while.
A long time.
And get a prenup.
Get a prenup. And you know what? Maybe when the daughters are happy with the guy.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I mean. Maybe listen to your daughters
because they weren't wrong.
It seems like they weren't ever really wrong.
It
never really worked out with any of those guys. Yeah. Now, it might have not worked out because they weren't supportive of their relationship.
Maybe.
That's a possibility. That's a reason why second, third, fourth marriages fail.
That is a reason.
But if your kids don't like him, maybe use that as at least a chance to slow down.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So next time.
Next time. Oh, we're going to have a good time.
We are going to have a good time because, and I've never seen this movie. I know The Secret. But I've not seen the actual movie, which is Fight Club. Yes. Brad Pitt. Thanks again for tuning in for this encore episode of The Dirty Truth About John, all about Dirty John and his horrible, horrible story. We're so glad that most people came out of that A-OK. Don't forget tune in next time. We're going to be talking about Killing Eve, and it is absolutely going to be one you do not want to miss. Until next time, be safe, be kind, and wash your hands. Bum, bum, bum. Bum, bum. Da, 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 da.